that's when the government started manipulating the way that they calculated the CPI.
Ed Butowski is an American financial advisor and author. In 2005, he founded Chapwood Investments, a private wealth management firm that was among the first to assist professional athletes. He also created the Chapwood Index. It reports the unadjusted actual cost and price fluctuation of the top 500 items on which Americans spend their after-tax dollars in the 50 largest cities in the United States. Many find this to be a more accurate version of the CPI. Today, we will break down what the Chapwood Index has been signaling and why the Federal Reserve's version of the CPI is flawed and incorrect.
The government could not handle giving out 13% increases in their programs, like Social Security and Medicare and so on. So they started to manipulate it. So the CPI went from 13% down to 3% in a year.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Ed Butowski, thank you for joining us, and sorry for the technical difficulties. We're using our backup streaming service right now.
Well, that's fine. I'm not the most computer literate person, but but this works.
Well, I think whether or not you're computer illiterate, I think the work that you're doing at Chapwood Investments, particularly with the Chapwood Index, is something that I admire greatly, particularly as somebody who's been writing about the economy for 7 years now, looking for better inflation metrics than what the BLS puts out with the CPI. I found that your work and the work from Shadow Stats more directly imbues what I'm feeling throughout the economy when I'm going and shopping at the grocery store, going to fill up my gas tank, paying insurance bills on a month-to-month basis, and extremely excited to have you on just to get a background of the Chapwood Index, why you decided to put it together, how you put it together, because it's something that I've been following and have only ever heard a few interviews from you before, and just want to dive into this because I think this is a very important topic that many Americans have at the top of their mind right now, particularly as we head into election season.
Absolutely. So the way that I started this was I initially had this idea, and it all goes back to my mother. When she got divorced from my father, and my mother got a job when she had cancer. And I said, why'd you get a job at Macy's? She said, because your effing father didn't adjust my alimony for cola. And I thought, cola? You drink Tab. I didn't even know what cola was at that time. And then I started looking into it, and I realized there was a gentleman named Albert Singlinger in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, who was doing an analysis on the old ways that the government used to calculate inflation versus how they were doing it now. And this was in 1994 that I had this conversation with my mother. And Albert Singlinger was referencing back to 1983 because that's when the government started manipulating the way that they calculated the CPI, because the CPI was at 13%. And the government could not handle giving out 13% increases in their programs, like Social Security and Medicare and so on. So they started to manipulate it. So the CPI went from 13% down to 3% in a year. Well, the prices didn't stop going up that much in 1 year. The government started manipulating the way they did it. So if you went back and used the old rules of how they calculated it, you would find that inflation was growing at around 8 or 9% a year. So I had a conversation with John Williams, who runs Shadow Stats. And I said, well, why don't you do this for every city? Because every city has a different cost of living increase. And it's not the cost of living that's important, it's the cost of living increase that's important. And he said he didn't have time to do it. And I thought, okay, well, I'll ask all of my clients to fill out what they're spending their money on today, and then have them track their own cost of living increase. I sent out a request to all of them. Not one of them did it. So I thought, okay, well, then I need to do this somehow. So I got people on Facebook to go out to their grocery stores and other places and start doing it for me. So these are my friends, and they started doing it quarterly, and it got to be too much, so we do it twice a year. And these are the real out-of-pocket costs that people spend money on to keep a constant standard of living. So in California, it won't surprise you that their cost of living increase is far greater than Taos, New Mexico is. And New York is going to be a lot greater than Denver is. Although it's interesting to note that a lot of Democrat cities where there's a heavy spending in the cities, their cost of living increase is far greater than red cities. And that's not a political statement, it's just factual.
And so that in the 90s, is that when they introduced hedonic adjustments, mid-90s? Is that what that, that change in the CPI was?
It was the 83-84.
83-84.
Right, but I started understanding it, really looking into it when my mother was sick. And that's when I became really just amazed by the manipulation, because her costs were going up so much quicker, even though my father didn't adjust her alimony for COLA. I started looking into it and realized what a bogus thing this was, because you have so many people who are relying on their cost of living increase to keep them in pace or keep them up with what their real cost of living increase is. So they're looking to the CPI to be adjusted realistically. But like just now, you had a 2.5% growth for January 2025. Well, anybody who thinks that their cost of living increase is only 2.5%, you know, they're absolutely misguided. So they're going to be spit in their face by about 5 to 7%. Their lives are going to get harder. That's why grandmothers and grandfathers' presents get worse as the years go on, because they're living off of this money, and they can't keep pace with the cost of living increase.
Well, that, I mean, and that's the other nefarious tactic that the government uses, particularly this administration. Not trying to get political, just being objective of how things are positioned in the market. And the Biden administration has been championing the fact that CPI inflation has been falling since the beginning of this year, end of last year. And they neglect to acknowledge the fact that even though it's a smaller rate of inflation, according to CPI, I think we would both argue that CPI is underscoring inflation dramatically. But even if you're running with the assumption that CPI is somewhat accurate, they're mischaracterizing the fall in inflation. It's really the fall in inflation rate, which is building on a higher base, which is still squeezing people post 2020.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I wish I could do a 60-minute segment on this, because what I would focus on is that this is one of the reasons why we have so much crime in the inner cities. Because people in the inner cities, again, just being very general here, they are middle-income people to lower-income people. And these people rely on somebody giving them a thumbs up or a thumbs down based on what their performance was. They don't get a chance to make extra money based on their performance. So they get an increase based on the government CPI number. And if that CPI number is low or lower than what their expenses are, it only takes about 5 years of being, you know, smushed in the face by being, you know, 5% behind what their cost of living increase is. Then all of a sudden they're 25% behind, and then they're going to start to commit crimes, because everyone has a threshold of pain. And when you reach it, you know, they're paying their taxes, they're doing everything right, but they just keep falling further and further behind. And this is one of the main reasons I think we have inner city crime, is because of the misguided number from the CPI.
And shifting back to the index and the data collection, there's 500 items, correct?
It's down to 150 now.
Down to 150. And in terms of data collection, like, are you essentially indexing people buying the same good from the same place, or are the goods substitutable between different stores or different gas stations, if you will?
Well, I try to get people to buy the same thing over and over again at the same store. So my data collectors are going to the same stores looking at the same items.
Yeah. And I mean, if you go on Chapwood Index and you look at the numbers, I mean, particularly the major cities since 2020 and even before then, double digits to mid double digits to mid teens in many of these cities on an annual and semi-annual basis. Like what do you think, like with the Fed lowering rates by 50 bips and all of the rhetoric and policy changes that have been made in your mind, have they been effective at all? Are we setting ourselves up for 1970 style echo inflation with the Fed cutting rates at this particular point in time?
Well, that's a little bit of a different discussion than the index. That's my interpretation of the cost of living. Is it going higher or lower? And will it go higher or lower? I believe that the Fed's going to have to continue to cut interest rates mainly because of the GDP number, not because of inflation. I think the GDP number is woeful, and we're going to have to lower interest rates to stimulate the economy. And if the CPI or if inflation isn't under control, then we're going to see it exacerbated. So you're going to see rising prices again when they lower interest rates.
Let's see that. I was mentioning before we recorded that I watched an interview that you did with Kitco News a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week, in which you mentioned just this. They're going to be focused on GDP, which is not surprising to me, but it was it did stick out to me, because if you hear the Fed talk, they're always targeting the inflation rate and talking about getting to the level they want to before feeling comfortable lowering rates. But you seem to think that GDP is much more top of mind for the Fed. And so in terms of GDP, like diving deeper into what the actual or what the reported numbers look like, and then your thoughts on whether those reported numbers are actually indicative of what's actually happening in terms of productivity throughout the economy.
Yeah. So again, not to sound like a conspiratory, you know, everything is a conspiracy, but when you look at the GDP numbers, you have to look at how GDP is calculated. And there's something called the GDP deflator. And that is the inflation number that they're able to assign to the GDP. And if that number is low, that means growth would be higher. And they're able to assign a very low number to the GDP deflator. Therefore, the number, you know, the GDP growth could be higher. So they assign a very low number to it, and they still are getting a pretty woeful, and I keep saying woeful, I don't know why, but they keep getting a woeful number on the GDP. But if they were to assign the real real inflation number, then GDP would be, you know, negative. But they're able to manipulate it by having a higher or a lower GDP deflator number. So think of GDP deflator as a placeholder for inflation. And they're able to assign a lower inflation number to the GDP number, therefore making the growth in GDP seem higher.
Is it even lower than the CPI, the deflator?
I believe so.
What is their justification for using a lower number?
To make the GDP number look higher.
It's just to game the numbers.
That's it.
Yeah. And it's...
No growth in the economy right now at all.
No, I think the jobs numbers would point to this too. If you look at jobs growth, particularly over the last 3 years, a lot of it has been either immigrants taking a lot of the jobs or government jobs, basically taking up a bunch of the positive jobs growth in the U.S. And then on top of that, you have the backwards revisions that have been pretty woeful themselves over the last 2 years.
Yeah, so you stole my word woeful.
I did.
So, you know, I don't understand how illegal immigrants can get jobs. If they're not legal, how are they taking jobs? Like, how is that happening? I don't get that. Is everybody just breaking the law?
Yeah, I mean, in the post-COVID world, it seems like the appetite to actually enforce the law has decreased a bit, particularly in some cities. You're talking about inner city problems and looting looting stores. If you steal less than $1,000, you're not even going to get a slap on the wrist. They're going to say just walk away. That's a great question. And you had Jerome Palamas explicitly admit that illegal immigrants taking jobs is quote unquote good for the economy because it helps employers pay lower wages to keep producing goods and services.
Yeah, you just wake up one day and you think, what kind of world do we live in? Like, what do we accept as the truth? You can't accept the CPI numbers as the truth. You can't accept the GDP numbers as the truth. You can't accept the number of migrants that are coming into this country. You can't really accept anything anymore as the truth.
So for this episode of TFTC is brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Do you have an old IRA or 401k that isn't keeping up with Bitcoin? Roll it over into an Unchained Bitcoin IRA and take advantage of Bitcoin's long-term potential while enjoying tax-deferred growth. With Unchained, you hold real Bitcoin and keep control of your keys, reducing counterparty risk through their collaborative custody model, while Unchained handles the tax forms. It's very important. They handle the tax forms. Get started now with no setup fees and no account fee for the first year. Not only is this the only standard Bitcoin IRA where you can control keys, unlike other Bitcoin IRAs, you can take distributions directly in Bitcoin, avoiding exchange fees. Set up a Roth or traditional Bitcoin IRA for no charge today at unchained.com/TFTC and experience true ownership of your retirement savings. Go to unchained.com/TFTC. This rip is also brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. CoinKite builds the best Bitcoin hardware in the world. There is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. If you're looking to secure and self-custody your Bitcoin, you can get the MK4 or the ColdCard Q. ColdCard Q has a full keyboard, a QR scanner, NFC enabled, has a battery pack. Put some AA batteries in there, create private public keys off pair in an air gap fashion. Private keys never have to touch an online device. They have their Sats card, which is the best way to give Bitcoin. If you're looking to gift Bitcoin for a wedding, a birthday party, a communion, a bar mitzvah, whatever it may be, tap the card on the back of your phone. You get a address to send to. You send it to that address. It lives on the Sats card. Again, there is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. The Bitcoin price seems to be going up. You want to take care of your security before Bitcoin goes to six figures. Make sure you get your Bitcoin off exchanges using CoinKite hardware. MK4, ColdCard Q. Go to CoinKite.com. Use the code TFTC. We have a code now, TFTC, for 5% off at checkout. Living in a day and age where we are completely detached from the truth, like how much systemic risk do you think that introduces for the American economy?
What situation?
Just gassing the numbers, lying to people about inflation, lying to people about jobs, lying to people about GDP, sort of band-aiding over what seems to be a systemically fragile economy. Obviously, we're expanding the debt astronomically, just added $450 billion, I believe, in the last 3 weeks leading up to this election, approaching $36 trillion. Obviously, we have interest expense on the debt approaching $1.2 trillion annually. It seems to me that the emperor is naked. And they're trying to project to the country that everything is well, we're going to get through this, but it seems like they're kicking the can down the road and trying to make everybody believe that things are going to be okay, but it's almost like somebody putting their head in the sand, an exuberant amount of cognitive dissonance that could lead to a pretty terrible economic outcomes due to the inability to actually confront the actual problems.
Well, I think most of this is wonky to most people out there, so they don't really understand what we're talking about. But when you talk about the amount of money that we bring in and how much money we pay out in terms of government programs, and we add $2 trillion a year to our national debt, and that is about a quarter of what we bring in tax revenue, when people start to really understand it, they're then going to understand that there's no way around this because we continue to want to spend more money. And there's always going to be programs out there, regardless if Trump's elected or if Harris is elected, we're still going to see massive spending way over and above what our tax revenue is. So we're at a point of no return. And the only way we can get around this is to drill underneath us and bring in more tax revenue that way. But most people don't understand how the world works and how the economy works. So you know, there's not going to be, you know, riots in the streets over this, except when we go to war and we have to, you know, have a war to get out of this economic misery that we're in.
That's the sad thing, that the only way to get out of this, and some people's, I'm not saying this to you, but the government's probably thinking, we got to go to war, we got to fix the economy. And I mean, when you think about it, going back to Jerome Powell's and the Fed's rate cuts last month, if you look at the long end of the yield curve, like it's still going higher despite the fact that rates went lower, which is not a good signal. And I mean, that gets to the bigger question. I think many people, predominant macroeconomic analysts and many people in TradFi, think that the U.S., due to its ability to issue this debt and have international players and sovereign actors buy the debt whenever it's auctioned, people think that is something that's going to continue to happen. But it seems like the demand for this treasury debt is waning as the world wakes up to the fact that we do not have our spending under control, and it doesn't look like we even have the ability to get it under control. And I don't think many people in the U.S. want to admit it, but I'll just throw this out to you to get your thoughts on it. But like, are we approaching sovereign debt crisis levels where things really get out of control?
Yeah, I don't think we are, because too many people view our debt in relationship to our GDP, our gross domestic product, and that they say that we're about 120% of our debt to our GDP. So they don't think that that's a tragic level. But something I wanted to also mention is that the more money that we print, the less value our dollars are worth. So when we have to print more money, the value of what we currently have in our pockets buys less. And that's also very inflationary. You can look at M2 statistics, and you can look at when M2 goes up, money supply, you can see inflation numbers go up, and those are the government's numbers go up. So that's another important point that might be a breaking point where inflation just gets rapidly out of control, and people then start to understand that it's because of our spending, and our spending is coming because of new bridges and roads and, you know, CHIPS programs and all these other Green New Deals, and all of this stuff is costing you money today. It's making the dollars you have today worth less every single minute.
Yeah, we have, I have a good friend, his name is Matthew Mazinkius, out of Riga, Latvia, American citizen who moved to Latvia, and we've been doing a quarterly update episode. He monitors the global monetary base, broken up by every currency, and that, I think, has become my favorite metric of real inflation over time. And I think going back to the 70s, he's run the numbers for the compound annual growth rate of the monetary base, the global monetary base, is something like 13.7% year on year for the last five decades.
Well, you know, under Tim Geithner, when the world had a liquidity crisis, he went out and told everybody to print more currency. So he said, print more euros, print more dollars, print more yen. And that has just inflated the monetary base tremendously. And that's become inflationary across the board. Mm-hmm.
And as a wealth advisor, how do you approach this inflation problem in terms of positioning your clients?
Well, I tell them the truth. I don't use one of these bogus statistics that inflation is 2 or 3%. I tell them the inflation is 6 to 7%, and that they have to do something to make sure that, you know, I can put a plan together for them that is just filled with fraud, meaning 2 or 3% inflation. But that's just not an accurate number. I use 6-7%, and then show them how much money they need to make in order to not lose purchasing power.
How do you manage risk with that? Does that push you out further on the risk curve?
To not try necessarily. To be there? When you use modern portfolio theory, you can have a lower risk portfolio by having assets that are non-correlated to each other. So you don't have to have a lot more risk to get really good non-correlated returns. You just have to have non-correlated assets. You have to have alternative investments in a portfolio. And most investment firms limit your alternative portfolio or your alternative allocation to about 15%. and 15% does not do it for you. You have to have more than that in an all, in an overall portfolio.
Yeah, out of college, I worked for a managed futures fund, and we were one of those alt funds, and we were fighting for 5% of the portfolio at the time. This was 10 years ago now at this point.
Well, managed futures is one of my favorite alts because it's non-correlated. You want to get technical analysis done, and that's how you manage it. You really get the non-correlated asset through something like managed futures.
This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. You got to be hydrating, freaks. And while you're hydrating, you got to be getting your electrolytes. This is the best electrolytes mix that I've ever come into contact with. Pink Himalayan salt with calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, no sugar. It tastes incredible. My favorite is the orange and the pink lemonade. Go to drinksote.com. That's drinksote.com. Use the code TFTC when you make your purchase and you'll get 15% off. I'm telling you, get on it, freaks. You're going to love this stuff.
What are your thoughts on, this is a Bitcoin show. This is something I've been passionate about while I was working at the Managed Futures Fund. That's when I found Bitcoin. I was on the portfolio management team as an analyst, and I was had to write the commentaries for the fund. And this was during Operation Twist QE2, so when Yellen was at the helm. And I just found it completely idiotic the way the global monetary system was managed, particularly one instance where Janet Yellen had a press conference and she was wearing a purple pantsuit, and traders took that as a signal that she's feeling regal. She's feeling like she was in a position of strength. So some markets traded based off of what she was wearing. That seemed completely insane to me. And then you couple that with what we discussed earlier, is the fact that a lot of these governments are in a position where they continually need to debase the money to basically have everything sustain itself, this Ponzi sustain itself. And so intuitively, I got Bitcoin about a decade, 11 years ago, and have been passionate about it ever since, because I do think it's a solution to this money printing problem if we can leverage an asset that's not controlled by any central authority, cannot be controlled by any company or government or central bank, and is an emergent market good. That seems like a good solution to this money printing problem to me. I'm curious to get your thoughts on Bitcoin.
Well, you're not going to like my opinion on Bitcoin.
But it's okay.
I'm old school in that I want there to be something backing the asset that I'm involved with. And the dollar, what's backing it is the ability to print more dollars, and you have the U.S. economy behind it. Bitcoin, there's nothing behind it other than people's desire to own Bitcoin. So I'm not into crypto, although I will tell you, I have a client of mine who's very wealthy, and he bought GBTC, and I went ahead and bought 1,000 shares of it, and I'm up $3,000 on it. So I'm not, you know, completely out of the idea of doing it, but it's very difficult for me to support something that doesn't have anything backing it other than the idea that everybody else wants to own it. And the idea now that, as you stated, that you're going to have to go and have everybody repurpose their currency into Bitcoin to make that worthwhile, away from the dollar, away from all the other currencies, I think that's a heavy lift in our lifetime.
It's definitely going to take a while. Gradually, then suddenly is what a lot of people say here. But I would push back and say that I don't think Bitcoin is not backed by anything. It's backed by a network of consensus rules of people making active decisions to abide by those rules. And then on top of that, there is a connection to energy that is, that sort of, I don't want to say it backs Bitcoin, but it makes it very hard to game in the sense that you need an immense amount of energy to overwrite the transactions on the network. But we don't have to get into a debate about the merits of Bitcoin.
Because I would lose. I don't know enough about it. You could talk circles around me, but I just basically want there to be something tangible backing every investment. Like if there's a stock, like let's say it's a Hershey's chocolate, I know that they sell Hershey's chocolate bars and they sell things, and there's something backing the share of stock. And if there's a bond, I know that there's something backing that bond. When it comes to the dollar, I know that the U.S. economy and the ability to print more dollars backs it. When it comes to Bitcoin.
Yeah. There's a network of people who can't change it. And there's rules that cannot. It's backed I've got a book I'll send you. I wrote the foreword to it. It's called Gradually and Suddenly. My good friend Parker Lewis wrote it. And that's one of the chapters in the book is Bitcoin is not backed by nothing, and gets into the merits of the network, because it is this weird thing to try to grasp. It's this digital good. It seems ephemeral, but there are sort of consensus rules codifying the backing of the legitimacy of the network. So they give you certainty that things operate the way you expect them to, and cannot be corrupted easily. Very, very hard to corrupt, but to a broader point discussing it, because it seems as a millennial, two young children, wife looking to build to the future and looking out at this runaway inflation, this runaway debt crisis, it's why I'm so passionate about Bitcoin, because it seems like there are no mechanisms from within the system to actually fix this problem. It seems like you have two roads that you can go down. It's your U.S. government overt default on the debt, which is never going to happen because it's geopolitically unpalatable, or default via debasement, which seems inevitable at this point.
Yeah. Look, anybody who really is, you know, has any kind of intelligence at all that really sits down and studies this will walk away with a very uncomfortable feeling about the future of our economic base. I mean, it's really, really that sad and difficult to comprehend just how bad things are. And we're not any better than any other country out there. In fact, we're probably, you know, worse than most because we're so much bigger.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what worries me the most, is that there's this perceived protection due to the size of the government and the economy and how long we've been in pole position globally as an economic power. And you look out at the world with the wars popping off in the Middle East, Russia, Ukraine, and then you see the BRICS countries meeting as we speak right now, talking about how they want to diversify away from dollar exposure because the U.S. government has weaponized the financial system, freezing assets, freezing the ability for people to move money between borders. Do you think the government has made missteps in the last 4 years with how they've weaponized the dollar system? And mm-hmm. Do you think they understand the ramifications of that weaponization?
Yes, but at the same time, 60% of trade is done, I think these numbers are right, in U.S. dollars, or 60% of the currencies out there are U.S. dollars. I don't believe that we're going to get away from the U.S. dollar being the currency of the world, the reserve currency, because the only one that could come up is China, and that's a communist country. And the other countries are too small. I think that the U.S. is going to remain the leader in the reserve currency for world trade. But the U.S. has definitely made mistakes along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's. Do you think this election's critical for the direction of the country and the economy?
Oh, without question. I don't think you've ever had a time where you had two candidates who are so opposite in how they want to address the economy and the world. You know, it's no secret that I'm a Trump supporter, but I'm a Republican more than a Trump supporter. And I believe that we need conservative economic policies, and we need to have lower taxes to stimulate growth versus raising taxes on people. And, you know, there's so many things that I'm against the Democrat platform that, you know, now will Trump get in there and cut spending? I don't believe so. But I think he's going to increase revenue into the tax base. You know, every single time that we've ever cut taxes, we've increased revenue. Now, the question is, how did they spend that money? Under Bush, the money was spent, so that therefore you had a higher debt and deficit under Bush. But by cutting taxes, you increase the revenue. Same thing with Trump, but he continued to spend money, but he had to because of COVID.
Yeah.
But the only way that we're going to get out of this is to cut taxes, and that's the only way.
That, I mean, I hope he can cut spending. I mean, he's talking a big game, trotting Elon out at a lot of campaign stump speeches and saying that he's going to get him in and slash all these useless bureaucratic agencies within the federal government. And it can, I mean, I don't know if it can be done here in the United States, but just broadly speaking, look at Argentina the last year, and they've done a good job of completely decimating that bureaucratic layer within their government. Obviously their economy is still going through some turbulence, but should be expected when you have such a drastic shift in policy from one administration to the other. And why don't you think he'll be able to cut spending? Because maybe I'm naive, optimistic, but I would like to think that what he's going out there and pitching could actually be implemented if he gets into office.
Well, I don't know. You know, he's talking about, you know, money going out to, you know, different programs. And anytime you get, you know, when spending bills come up, there's always a need to, you know, take care of somebody. Like in Kentucky, you have Mitch McConnell, who's a huge, who gets tremendous amount of money from the U.S. government for the state of Kentucky. And they're always trying to increase those programs. So cutting some of the programs out of the government, like the Department of Education out, that's a Band-Aid. That's a minor thing, and we're hemorrhaging right now. So he's going to need to cut tremendous amount of programs, and we're going to see this country get smaller in terms of our expansion. Like here in Dallas, we have roads that are being, you know, worked on because of the programs, the infrastructure program that was passed, and they're getting so much money, they're just digging up roads, you know, roads that my wife says doesn't even need to be fixed, and she knows, believe me. And you know, I think that there's just a tremendous amount of nonsensical spending that goes on with the government, and I just don't believe that Trump by himself is going to be able to cut that back.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Now, it reminds me of my days at the Managed Futures Fund. I lived in Chicago for 5 years, and around the fourth year, I became aware of the jobs program they had in the city, which is they would pave the roads with mid-grade gravel every spring and summer. So that when you're driving through the salted and snowy roads in the winter, they would inevitably get torn up, and you'd have essentially an annual jobs program every spring and summer of people going and repairing those roads. It's insane. Just use the high grade gravel so you don't have to fix the roads every year.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife is so frustrated over how many roads are being torn up in Plano, and the roads look perfect, but they have so much money that they need to spend it.
Down here in Austin, too, we're seeing it. We've had South Lamar has been completely blocked off for 2 months, and they haven't even started working on it. They've just blocked it off and prevented traffic from flowing normally and making it harder for me to get into work. And it seems like they're preparing for something but aren't actually getting anything done.
Well, the point about Trump is that Trump has never been a conservative. He's always been a big spender, and he proved that during his first administration. And you know, Kamala Harris, if the Democrats win, you know, they already have all of these programs that they want to spend money on or forgive loans. There's just so many handouts that they want to give or where they want to forgive things, which also becomes a negative for the debt and the deficit. So we're going to have to get spending under control at the same time that we get our revenue up. And I just don't have a lot of hope that the Republicans are going to be able to pull this off.
Yeah. On the Democratic side, are you saying that giving people $25,000 to buy their first home is a bad idea?
Yeah. I know. Where was my $25,000?
Yeah. The on this line, like maybe it's not the federal government that can solve this. And I think that was one of the silver linings of the post-lockdown era or during the lockdowns was this assertion of autonomy by individual states and this walking back towards the direction of federalism, the way the republic was originally set up. Do you have hope of that trend continuing? States basically looking, do the states have to come in and say, the federal government, you're insane. We're sending too much money to you. Don't worry. Like, we don't need your money. We're gonna take care of it here and become a bit more insular versus the federal government.
Well, if you look, I was looking the other day at the state budgets. I know that'll tell you how exciting I am. But I was looking at the debt clock and I looked at the state budgets and almost every state is underwater. So they need government and money to subsidize their spending. So I can't imagine that any state is going to be able to pull things off without the federal government's money.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think we need an energy renaissance to really kickstart things? Do you think Trump's idea to drill baby drill to drive down energy prices is an effective way to fix these problems if you're not going to cut spending?
Yeah, but what surprises me is that we are producing more fossil fuel in each month than has ever happened in this country. So there's a lot of discussion about how this administration has slowed down the amount of drilling, but we're drilling more. We're producing more than we ever have in the history of our country, which is shocking to most Republicans.
Yeah. I think it's not, the LNG is what we're shipping abroad, right? So, and the oil, we're net exporters of oil now too.
We're producing so much on a monthly basis, more than we ever have, but there's all this rhetoric that the Democrats have cut the amount of drilling that we're doing. So I don't understand the contradiction there.
Yeah. Maybe we're getting more efficient at drilling. I don't know. It's I got to have Dr. Nasser Haji on. Do you hang out with him at all up in that area of Texas?
No. I would love to know what he says about that.
Yeah. He's our go-to oil and gas expert here at TFTC. But Ed, I know we started a bit late. I want to be respectful of your time. This has been a great conversation. I just want to thank you for the Chapwood Index. It's something that I follow and write about quite often. And I think it's an incredible service to U.S. citizens because they should have better information about what is happening to their lives and what is eating at their pocketbooks and their wallets. It is a shame that the government feels compelled to manipulate the data and paper over what I deem to be systemic problems and essentially lying to the American public. And so I want to thank you for surfacing the truth and giving people better information.
Well, absolutely. And the new numbers should be out in about 2 weeks.
All right. And we can find that. It's chapwoodindex.com, correct?
Correct. And I have to ask you, the numbers to your right shoulder, what are those?
So this one right here, this is sats per dollar. So there's 100 million Satoshis in one Bitcoin. So right now, $1 will get you 1,486 Satoshis.
Okay.
Yeah, so Bitcoin's divisible. It's portable. It's extremely scarce. It's backed by a massive network of energy, making sure the network runs, and individuals who are making sure that the rules are followed. That's what it's backed by.
Send me that book.
And this is the block height. We're at block height 866,878. So since January 3rd, 2009, 866,876 blocks of transactions have been produced on the network.
I'm happy I asked.
This is the Block Clock by CoinKite. Great, great product.
All right. Take care.
Ed, have a great day. Peace and love, freaks.